Get ready for a week-long celebration of music, community, and fabulous fun with Joy Radiothon 2024. Joy has the largest collection of rainbow podcast content in the world, and you can help keep us out loud and proud by donating during Joy Radiothon 2024. Just go to joy.org.au/radiothon. Mark it in your calendars because Joy Radiothon returns June 1st to 7th. And remember, we all flourish with joy.
You're listening to a Joycast from GLB, TIQ community radio station Joy 94.9.
And good evening. You're on the Spirit Lounge on Joy 94.9. And we just attempted to play a CD, which is jumping all over the place. So you have to listen to our dulcet tones instead. Joy, would you like to sing a song, darling?
Oh, I would love to, but I don't think
anyone else would like me.
Anyway, you're with the three P's, the priest, the pom and the puff. We're here every Tuesday night from 9 till 10. That's our new slot. Of course, we used to be here on a Monday. And we're talking about sexuality and spirituality and integrating the two, are we not?
We are, and I'm still trying to put my phones and everything onto silent.
Yep, you're still trying to switch everything off. We're all still trying to find the answers to life. And Mr. Puff.
Yes?
Okay, how are your New Year resolutions getting on?
My New Year's resolutions are going fine.
And what were they?
Fine. Excellent.
Share.
To be nice to the pom and the priest, I think, was number one. And that's probably not going so well.
I didn't have to make a resolution about that. I already am nice to you. No, my resolution was to try and get rid of... It's the same thing that I always... do every year, and it was to try and rid myself of any kind of static, for want of a better word, in my life.
We're out.
Okay, better switch the power. Switch the power off then.
So basically, what that means is just trying to focus on doing the things that I really love and really want to do, instead of doing all sorts of other things that really don't matter. So. That was my resolution last year, and I think I was fairly successful at sticking to it, but it's the kind of thing that every year I try and remember and try to do that again.
And do you go through and make a list of the things that you want to get rid of in the coming year, or how do you work it?
It's not a physical – it's not actually jot down a list, but I do have like a list in my head of the priority that I want to give to things.
Aww. Yeah, so. What about you, Priesty?
I don't believe in making New Year's resolutions.
Is that because you can never achieve them?
Exactly. I just think you make changes throughout the whole year, and I just think that it puts pressure on if you make a New Year's
resolution. Yeah, I think it's such a significant kind of celebration of time passing, isn't it, that people use that to kind of wipe the slate clean and start again. And I think it's interesting reading about it on the internet. You know, a lot of people make New Year resolutions, but of course they do change during the year because your life changes during the year. Sometimes you never know it's around the corner. But yeah, I'm crap at keeping them, really.
The most popular one is to give up smoking.
Yeah.
Followed by to lose weight. And apparently most people fail in both.
Yeah,
so,
and there's a lot of really grumpy people around in January.
Yeah, but I like Andrew's idea of thinking about the whole year and getting rid of, what do you call it, static?
Well, I call it static. I just imagine, you know, like when you're trying to tune in the TV and it's probably not so relevant with digital TVs around these days.
You know, he's only young, but he talks like an old person, doesn't he?
He does sometimes.
Sometimes.
Well, do you think we're old people?
Well, we are. Not as
speak
old as,
for yourself.
not as old as Andrew thinks I am, though.
No. You're never going to let me live that one down, I'm sure.
I'm not. I'm going to bully you and embarrass you for the rest of your life about that. But I think after the overindulgence of Christmas is a time to cut back, which I am trying to do, not very well. I think it's a time to exercise some willpower, self-control, resist temptation, which is all, I think, what you have to do to cut back, really, don't you? Break bad habits, maybe. Yeah, I try and set new goals. And I read this lovely phrase the other day. It said, live your dreams instead of chasing them, which I thought was nice.
Yeah.
So I'm trying to live my dreams instead of just being hot pursuit the whole time.
Yeah.
It's a cute little phrase, isn't it?
Some people are sort of trying to just keep from going under.
Well, depends. How do you mean?
Well, there's some people, I guess, not in such a good place.
Sure.
And Christmas is such a difficult time for them.
Sure, yeah.
That to get through the new year without going under is quite an achievement.
Absolutely, yeah. Yeah, that doesn't need any resolution really, does it?
Yeah. Especially, you know, with families and people who are coming out and stuff around Christmas, it's a really difficult
Yeah, can be a very difficult
time.
To bring everyone together and hope they're all going to be accepting and you're going to have a happy family situation, and often you don't.
Yeah, I mean, we were fortunate enough at Christmas to have several non-family members who, you know, chose to have Christmas with us rather than try and fight the family.
Did you have the open sign on outside?
We did.
So, we had a bit of a collapse of the music to start with. So, I think
we might try it again. I've swapped CD players.
Okay.
Brushed the dust off the other one.
Okay. Well, this young lady is, in fact, our artist of the month, and her name is Freya Hanley. And she's a very lovely young Australian singer. I call her music kind of a mix of jazz and folk. She's coming in next week to the show. She's going to be playing live. She's going to be talking to us about her life and her music.
That'd be great. She heard Andrew was not going to be here, so she's coming in.
That's why she chose next
week. That's why you organised it.
Let's give it another whirl. This is called New Sun. We have Michelle Grimshaw with us this evening, graduated from University of Melbourne with a Bachelor of Social Work in 1992 and published a research paper on the role of mourning ritual for a group of gay men with HIV/AIDS in the same year. Her interest in the role of ritual as a therapeutic tool stemmed from her work with disenfranchised grief and multiple losses at the Victorian AIDS Council and was developed further in her role as clinical coordinator at the Australian Centre for Grief and Bereavement. For the past 12 years, Michelle has worked as a private practitioner, providing counselling, supervision and writing counselling practical protocols, that's difficult to say, with senior practitioners in the loss, grief and trauma field. She also works at the Queer Counselling Service in Drummond Street. Welcome, Michelle.
Thank you.
Good to see you.
Good to be here.
All of this amazing stuff that we're talking about has made you incredibly qualified for what you do now. Mm. Can we talk about what is grief and what is loss?
Mm. What is grief and what is loss? Well, grief typically, as noted in the literature, you know, is the emotional response to loss. Mm-hmm. Okay, but it's more than the emotional response. You know, it's a physical response, it's an intellectual response, and it's a spiritual response. Mm-hmm. Because as you know, when you're grieving, and if you're grieving profoundly, you do go through, you know, what's the meaning of life? Why are we here? Where will I go? Is there a God? All the mortality issues and the existential issues. So typically it's written as the emotional response to loss. But what is loss? And that's the interesting thing. And, you know, I often struggle with that. It's hard to find a definition of loss. But I define it as the recognition of something that you've been attached to, mm-hmm. something or someone that has changed, ended or altered. And so that brings up, and this could be a number of things. As I say, the obvious one is thinking about relationships, the ending of mm-hmm. school, the ending of a course, the moving house, the missing animal.
Retirement's a big
retirement,
one too.
Yeah, the loss of youth, you know, going through menopause, mm-hmm. Finding out you're infertile if you want to have a child. This is loss. Mm-hmm. The career you never had, the things you never got to do, disability. Mm-hmm. And so forth. So the feelings, the emotional response to that and the cognitive could be a sense of missing, just missing, displacement, anxiety, sadness. And loss has a period of adjustment that's a lot, you know, it's different for everybody. But mm-hmm. whereas grief is more profound, it's loss. You may have some of those symptoms, if you like, or experiences more than symptoms, and you'll have symptoms.
So is grief bereavement, or is bereavement the practice of grief?
Bereavement is the term we tend to use when we're talking about death. You can be bereft of something in a sense that you feel it's died. You know, mm-hmm. I'm bereft of my relationship because it's died. It's mm-hmm. over. The connection's gone. And you can be bereft of your homeland because mm-hmm. I may never get back there. But generally speaking, bereavement is about some sense of permanence and mm-hmm. ending. So we tend to think largely around death. The practice of grief, if you like, culturally, the term for that is mourning.
Yes,
yeah,
of course.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. So when we're mourning, we are expressing grief as per our cultural norm.
But different cultures mourn in very different ways, don't
that's
they?
That's right, yeah. And and the Anglo culture, the one, you know, we tend to be sort of saddled with, is somewhat limited in its cultural rites of passage and the norms around you know, how to grieve. Yes, it's very much, you know.
Yeah, we're probably the worst at it. I mean, I come from New Zealand, and the Maoris.
Oh, yeah.
They have wonderful tangies.
Mm. Yeah.
And they all wail, and they get together, and they eat heaps of food, and they wail, and they mourn, and it's fabulous.
Mm. There's not a great outcry from us, is there? We seem to internalise grief, I think, as Poms and Kiwis. And do we?
I think we yeah. actually very uncomfortable with grief. And with someone who is upset, I think that we really don't cope with the discomfort.
We don't.
So we want to make them better.
That's right, yeah. We value stoicism, don't we, and you know, stiff upper lip. But we also value, I think, some of the cultural norms we have is, you know, that we can't make anyone feel any worse. There's a saying for that. It's that sense of kill the messenger. You know, as soon as someone gives us a message that they're grieving, we almost want to silence them because we fear that if whatever we say will upset them further and we do no harm, you know, do no more damage, when in fact, you know, we're really disservicing people by being so silent. And
yes, we're being oversensitive, really, aren't we?
Very much so.
And why do we get this feeling when you meet someone and you realise they're grieving? Why do we get this feeling that we have to fix it and make it better? And why do we react like that, do you think?
Well, I think, and there's some research around this too, that it really ignites a sense of helplessness. But again, the cultural norms and assumptions that we're operating from kick in as well. So the cognitive's going about, oh, you know, I've got to help this person. I've got to help them stay contained. This is our message, not to cry, not to lose it or crack up, all those sayings we have.
Yeah.
So, of course, it's impossible. So we feel doubly helpless, but we feel very helpless. We want to rescue, fix you. I think Coldplay have a great song about that, and I will fix you, you know. It's a beautiful song about Chris Martin wrote, I think, about his wife when her father died or she was grieving. I think that's my take on it anyway, that he wanted to fix her, you know, and stop the tears and stop the sadness. But we also don't want to go to where that might take us about our own grief and our own mortality.
Mm.
And we know that we can visit. We feel compassionate and empathic, but we visit our own pain when someone else is in pain.
Yeah.
And generally, even if they're strangers. Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, and we almost have a set time that we expect people to be over it by.
Don't we?
You know, I mean, whatever that time is that, oh, well, it's been 2 months now. Oh, it's been a year. We use a year often, don't we? You know, they've gone through the birthdays and Christmas and everything without that person. So they should be all right now.
Yeah, get over it sort of thing, yeah. But it's a very individual thing, isn't it?
That's right. Yeah, we do. We have the workplace policy around grief and even the burial policy, we have things like, well, you should be buried or cremated within 3 days. You shouldn't leave it too long. You know, hurry up, and you get 6 weeks off work if you're lucky, or 3 days compassionate leave if you're a carer. Or, you know, in fact, 6 weeks is
rare. I always wonder about that 3 days when it's your partner or someone.
Yeah, it's nothing, is it?
How do you get over and get back to work in 3 days?
You see, it's interesting because, I mean, people do react differently, don't they? And some people are desperate to get back to the norm as quickly as they can, which I guess is probably running away from the emotions that they have to go through. And other people, I think, just dive headlong into grieving.
Well, it's interesting you say that because people, you know, people grieve in their own unique way, but there's some work done that classifies people as grievers as either instrumental, which is another way of saying sort of task-focused, using their instruments, or more emotive, you know, just more expressing and less doing. And so when people want to go back to work, they may not necessarily want to, you know, they may not necessarily be not grieving or in denial. They're actually there giving themselves time on, time off, busy at their desk or whatever they're doing, and, you know, actually compartmentalising, as I say, the opportunities that they'll give themselves to grieve. And when they do grieve, they'll do it more intensely, whereas others are just need to talk, more extroverted.
And you're on Spirit Lounge with the Priest, the Pom and the Poof, otherwise known as Andrew, Bertie and Joy. And that track was one that Michelle referred to, and it's Coldplay with Fix You. And we're going to go back to the second part of the interview that we did with Michelle Grimsaw talking about grief.
Kubler-Ross developed the theory of the five stages of grief. Do we still adhere to that? And what were those original five stages?
Well, the original stages Kubler-Ross came up with in the 60s, I think it was 1961, were, oh, this tests my memory, shock, denial, anger, bargaining and acceptance. Mm. But she actually wrote those after research with people who themselves had terminal illness and were confronting their own death. And when they got the news and the shock and then the denial, no, I'm going to survive this.
Yeah.
And then, look, if I can't survive it, maybe I can get another couple of years. And then, you know, the anger, the rage, you know.
Why me?
Why me? Yeah. It's unfair. What have I done? And then the acceptance. Well, why not me? You know. So her work is still profoundly respected, but further work or future work since the 60s has actually denounced stage theory in the sense that nothing happens in a linear pattern.
Mm-hmm.
So you can come into receiving illness about a terminal diagnosis at anger.
Mm-hmm.
Or you could come in at acceptance, you know, and then you might go into shock.
And you can move in and out of many of the stages many times.
That's right. And you may not engage all of them. And so it's unhelpful, really, I think, in the long term, because people will pathologize people saying, oh, you're in denial. Or
and you should be moving into this stage.
And what can I do to get you into anger? Because you must get angry. Whereas I tend to think, you know, you don't have to get angry, but anger is often a healthy sign of a good ego saying, you know, hey, yeah. I've got a life. I've got a purpose. I've got meaning.
And it vents some emotion as well, doesn't it?
That's right.
Sometimes that can be good for you.
It vents energy, which is, you know, underlying all emotion is this profound need to release energy. So, you know, everybody's respectful of it. But in no way should we use it in a linear fashion, or in fact put anything on someone who's grieving as something that they're going to go through or need to go through. You know,
it's different for
you
everyone.
You don't need to go through anything but that which comes up for you.
Yeah.
Do people get stuck in grief?
That's always a common question, isn't it? You know, so it depends what we mean by stuck. Because for some people, it could mean that if you're crying for 3 days straight, you're stuck.
I guess we're talking more about people that are a fair distance down the track and are unable to actually re-engage with life.
That's right. Yes, people do, and I'm sure we've all met people who feel that I can't reconnect to life because that's disrespectful or dishonouring, or people may feel that may treat me as if I'm okay and I still need their support.
Mm.
There's all terms around pathologized grief or complex grief, complicated loss. And there are people who on an unconscious level need to hold on and they need to have that support and they need to, you know, generally be stuck in if you like, what's the shadow side of life or what, you know, what's hurt. I definitely don't think that it's helpful to immediately begin a new life of letting go immediately because, as you know, if you've been in a relationship that's ended, one of the things you might find yourself doing is catching up with your joint mutual friends all the time because you perceive that as a loss. You know, well, they were her friends or his friends. They're no longer my friends. They're supporting him. So you find yourself wanting to catch up one-on-one with them. And after time, as you adjust to the reality of the loss, you will be able to, you know, it's like the sands of time. Those people who will naturally gravitate towards you will, but you won't be so urgent to be in the past.
If you have someone close to you who perhaps has a terminal illness or, as Joy was saying, perhaps a mental illness like dementia, so they're kind of not there, you know, they're not on the same wavelength as us the whole time anymore, is there a grieving process that actually starts prematurely?
There is grief known as anticipatory grief, and they talk about people, you know, anticipating the loss and the losses to come with dementia, particularly progressive dementia. And a well-known grief academic, Beverly Raphael, who's Australian, you know, she sort of challenged that notion that, you know, for example, let me use the example of when you know someone's got cancer or a long-term illness that's going to go on and on. You know, she challenged it and said, you know, in some research that people who'd known, for example, their child, cystic fibrosis, for example, sadly, there is a percentage of young people who don't get past adolescence or early adulthood now, and hopefully that's diminishing. But parents who are then in the position where their child has died, even though they've known from birth that this is a potential likelihood, it's as if they've got the news for the first time.
Yeah.
So while you think you're preparing, there's a part of you when you're hit by that profound loss, you're bereft.
Yep.
It's a whole new ball game. It's like starting a whole new book. Because what you've been dealing with is a cumulative loss. You know, I was talking about loss before. So the missing, the displacement, the adjustment, and the same with the dementia and the Alzheimer's. So while you're not actually actively grieving, because the person's still here, you are experiencing loss, which has some of the symptoms of grief, some of the expressions of grief, where you'll lose it and then you'll buck up and you go, hang on, they're still here, you know.
So there's a huge element of shock, actually, isn't there, that hits you that I don't think anyone can ever anticipate.
No, but there's a huge element as well, once the shock does, you know, settle, of ongoing, what they call infinite loss. It's low-grade chronic loss. And so people who have children with disabilities, for example, you know, when their kid doesn't go to school on the first day because they're intellectually or otherwise not capable, again, they revisit the loss, you know. So there's this infinite, prolonged, low-grade, chronic grief, and it goes on for life, and your child's not getting asked out on a date, and your child's not going to get the job they want or could have had if they hadn't been hit by the car, or
what if.
And so it's low grade, and it's almost like a malaise and a missing and a hole in the heart. Whereas I guess some people say, you know, with bereavement, and there is a sense of some time down the track of accommodation and adjustment. You'll always miss them, but you've got that dark scarlet chamber in your heart that, you know, you've got a bit of padding around and you can come and go with your visits to it and it won't hurt as much. But the chronic ongoing, I think that's one of the hardest.
You're on the Spirit Lounge with the three P's, the priest, the pom and the puff. And we are talking to Michelle Grimshaw, who's just fascinating. Pre-recorded that just before Christmas, but it's lovely to listen to it again. Now, we've had an email in from Robert in Pascoe Vale. And Robert's asking the question, as people increasingly no longer see death in spiritual religious terms, how will this change personal grieving or traditions around death? I'm assuming, Robert, you probably mean traditions around burial and funerals. But Priesty, what do you think about that then?
Well, I think with personal grieving, it depends on what people actually believe. I mean, people may not go to church, they may not buy into the religious stuff, but they may still believe in a life after death. And so I think personal grieving is very much around what you believe. But we were just saying, it's interesting, after a disaster, that people do often go back to the church looking for comfort. Looking for something. I don't know if they find it.
It's like a sanctuary, a church sometimes, isn't it? It's a place of deep thought and peace, and if you're searching for the answers, it's quite often a place to go and sit quietly where you're actually not going to be disturbed in these modern days, are you?
Yeah, we talked to Michelle in the next part about ritual, and I think that's what's changing. You know, you have those fires of that whole family that was destroyed up in Queensland. What did they all do? They all gathered with candles and with flowers and stuff in the street. And I think traditions do change. You now have celebrants rather than ministers.
Yeah, exactly.
I mean, funerals.
Yeah. So if you don't have a deeply religious burial or funeral service, celebrants take that place, don't they?
And people will often go to the place where the person died and make that into a shrine and gather in those places and find comfort there.
Well, Robert, thank you very much for your email. That gave us something to talk about while we were listening to Michelle. Now, what's next, guys?
Andrew's track here.
We've got a wonderful track coming up from Laura Story. It's called Blessings. And I was kind of listening to this track during the week and I thought, oh, it's actually really lovely. It talks a little bit about how sometimes the challenges that we come across are actually kind of blessings in disguise.
So I would like to add something to that. I hope she's still listening. Sandy, my darling, if you're still listening in Corfu in Greece, then I'd like to dedicate this to you, my darling. This is the Spirit Lounge on Joy 94.9. And that was the beautiful Laura Story with a fabulous track called Blessings. Nice choice, Mr. Pufter.
It's one of my favourites, actually.
Very, very lovely. Now, we've had SMSs on fire tonight. We have had an SMS from Pete, and I'll just read it as he's typed it. Losing my father at just last year from stomach cancer, and although we knew he was terminal, it still hit us like a train in that last week when he took a turn for the worst. Then again, when he left. Being only a year after losing my brother and my nan, it can almost be too much loss. It makes me wonder if there is such a thing as too much loss. Joy, what do you think about that?
I think there is. And I think for people, you know, I was saying about after the bushfires that so many people died, so many friends and neighbours and people you knew, that people had to select who they grieved for. And they could only go to so many funerals and they could only miss so many people. And I think that when you have, like, we're talking about have three losses, it's huge. And I think that's a time that it's good to go and talk to a grief counsellor like Michelle, who works at the Drummond Street Clinic, or there's others in the ORSO directory, or through your GP, you can get a referral. I think that's a time you need to go and talk to someone.
Absolutely. What we were just discussing while that beautiful song was playing was I think, yes, there is something, too much loss, it certainly does exist. And I think what I was translating it as is too much loss when people just go, A, in a short space of time, and B, prematurely. I mean, we all know the ultimate way, you know, we're all going to die eventually. But I think when people prematurely go and gosh, poor thing, within 1 year, that's just
but I think we often say, and I used to get sick of this, I worked in aged care for a long time, they had a good life. When my grandmother died at 98, I was devastated.
Yeah.
It didn't matter she was 98.
Yeah, she's still...
You know, she's someone I had lived with. She's someone that I really related to, thought was a fabulous, spunky woman. and, you know, it doesn't matter what age they are. And, yes, I guess if it's someone younger, it's even more tragic. But, you know, we can grieve for anyone, no matter what their age or who they are.
Now, we've had one more SMS to read before we listen to the third part of Michelle's interview, which addresses ritual. And we've had a lovely email from Adam. Adam, hi there. Really enjoying the show. Always enjoy tuning in and hearing topics not discussed anywhere else on Joy. Glad to hear you're back for another season. And he's called us the Spirit Loungers. Thank you, Adam. It's great to hear you. Now, this is the final part with Michelle, and she's talking about ritual.
What is ritual? Ritual is a symbolic activity that marks, it has to mark something. So the two key issues are that it's something you do and with a symbol, either with an actual object that's a symbol or a symbolic activity that, you know, whether you stand in a circle or light a candle or release balloons, and there's hundreds of things you can do, or do something, water or fire, and all of the classical elements used in ritual.
So would spreading the ashes be
spreading the
one
ashes
of those?
Ashes is a mourning ritual, yes, and so is burial, and so are wakes, and there's pre-death and post-death ritual, there's pre-marriage and post-marriage ritual, there's some rituals that happen once only have three stages to them, so things like birth, death. And it used to be marriage, but that's no longer a one-off one-off life event.
So a ceremony is a ritual?
Not necessarily, because it may not have symbolic activity. It could just be an event. And that's the function of ritual. So it marks an event or a transition, and that's marking the death symbolically. But why does it do it? It does it so that we can release... express our grief symbolically rather than just, you know, subjectively holding it in or expressing in tears, and to share it within a group. You can do it on your own ritual, or you can do it in a group, and it creates a sense of support and strength in the group you do it with, and also a sense of camaraderie, and in some rituals continuity, because the ritual keeps happening, like Christmas year in year out, or the Anzac Day year in year out, or the, you know, and it's a sense of life goes on, and mm-hmm. We know this because here we go, we're having Anzac Day again.
Yeah.
And that creates a sense of continuity and safety that people need after trauma mm. and remembrance, of course. And the shock, too, it plays a role. It really, ritual does play a role in helping us, you know, really come to terms with the reality of the loss, which is considered a task of grieving. Let's talk about stages of grieving. That's stages of a process you go through, Kubler-Ross, when you're given bad news, if you like, or hard news. But when you're actually grieving, one of the first tasks is to confront the reality. So the best way to do that is to rock up at the place and go, this is where they died.
Mm.
And you can smell the ash, and you can see the road tires, and you can, you know, have a sense that it's kind of like a sacred space.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And it's almost like that sacred space. And I was watching the people that this fan that blew up in just the other day. There's these tough guys, but being at that space almost gave them the okay to cry.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. You know, because they were there with
it
others.
Opened them up.
It was almost like, well, while I'm in this space, it's safe.
Yeah, that's right. It's safe to be exposed and be vulnerable. It does open you up being in that space too.
Yeah.
Because you start using other parts of your brain where you get visual images, and you know, and so ritual is good for that, you know. Mm. It can make you vulnerable in a productive way, yeah.
So you talked about symbols. So what kind of things what are symbols in a ritual? I mean, is it someone who's passed away, a possession of theirs, or is it a photo of them, or what kind of things do people use as symbols?
All sorts of things people use as symbols, but traditionally, I mean, like I said, you know, the water, the earth, air, fire. So in the fireworks and your candles and your bonfires and your open fires. Food, of course, clinking of glasses, toasting, words, epitaphs, speeches. But the symbolic activities of circles, particularly, linking, holding hands, silence, on and on and on. And then again, objects belonging to the person, or that symbolise their life, or symbolise the meaning that they attributed to life, or symbolise the meaning you attribute to their death, or to their life. It's interesting, you know, one of the common symbols people have sometimes is the footy colours, or this footy song at a funeral, you know, isn't it? Because it tells you a lot, you know. You know, who they're barrack for, or that's, you know, obviously there's people, not myself, who are not into football at all. It's the power of the symbol, but it's also the power of just doing ritual, which you said earlier. Just start to do it and you feel this energy shift. And again, there's writing about that says that when you're actually using symbols, there's a part of your unconscious, the liminal space between, if you like, the unconscious and the conscious, that gets activated and starts to kind of, you know, without us actually being able to connect to it, relate to those symbols. There's something going on, and it's quite primitive. Or so the theory goes, and Jung has a lot to say about this, that takes place. So oftentimes you can be quite sceptical, but there's... This ritual's been used a lot in post-war combat fatigue. You know, so people who've coming back from war, particularly, who've been there for years, actually are now being encouraged to do certain sorts of ritual, if you like, what are called sweat lodges and things like that, where they sit around in the heat with symbols and just see what comes up, because often what comes up needs to come up and will come out there, which will never come up in a counselling session.
No.
And it may not be appropriate.
Quite healing, quite cathartic, isn't it?
Yes. Yeah. I mean, wouldn't it be wonderful if somehow we knew where people were who were suffering in the way we have, and just to get them to come together. I guess this was originally the role of the church. We could come together on a semi-regular basis just to, you know, have some, if you know, communal sharing and if you like, a hands-on, almost, for lack of a better word, blessing to say, you know, you're safe. This is a transition. You're in it. You'll come out of it.
Mm.
We'll help you come out of it, and do something symbolic to show the shedding of the fear and the shedding of the links to some of the fundamentalist teachings or some of the things that you've ingested that are actually toxically, you know,
And to connect with God's love again.
That's right, yeah. So to, yeah, something that we could do symbolically, and I guess that is harnessing the love within us and, you know, stand in that gap.
And that's a big thank you to Michelle Grimshaw for that wonderful interview about grief and ritual. And, of course, last week we talked to her about her own story and also what she does. So don't forget that you can hear those interviews again on our podcast. Is that right, Andrew?
Yes. Yeah, you can get to our podcast if you go to joy.org.au. Follow the links through to the Spirit Lounge page and you'll be able to see our podcast and re-listen to all of our content.
And also don't forget, if you're struggling with issues of grief or any other issues, please go and see your GP and you can get a referral to a counsellor, or you can look up the ORSO directory online or in the book, and there are counsellors there. And Michelle Grimshaw actually works at the Drummond Street Relationship Clinic, so you can find information in the ORSO directory and no doubt online about that. Now we're going to have another track.
We are. We've actually got one coming up. Now, we had a bit of trouble earlier in the show with our music.
Jumping CD.
It was a little bit all over the place, and I thought that I'd fixed it. And now I think I've fixed it again. So we're going to give it another go. We're going to give it one more go.
Okay.
And this is our artist of the month, Freya Hanley.
And if she doesn't do it this time, she's in trouble.
She's in big trouble. We'll just have to resort to getting her into the studio
live.
She can do it live every week, not just next week.
You're on the Spirit Lounge with the Three Ps, and we've been talking about grief and ritual today with Michelle Grimshaw, and we've had one final SMS in. As usual, the show covers important things that others do not, and at times of grief, as in right now for me, it's comforting to hear that you are not alone. Thank you to the Three Ps for a great show that stretches across the world. And that is from Anne in Biggin Hill in Kent in England. And Anne happens to me to be my gorgeous darling wife. And the reason she's in Kent is she very sadly is going to the funeral of her dear niece Yvonne, who passed away on Friday, lost her battle with cancer. So thank you for listening, sweetheart. And a very poignant program.
And love to you, Anne, from all of us here. We'll be thinking of you. So it's been quite an amazing program, isn't it?
It's been a great program and a fantastic subject to cover. And next week we have Freya Hanley with us, who's singing and playing live. And
And coming up now is going to be Sonia on Sci-Fi and Scream. And they're talking about gothic classic films.
And I think vampires, aren't they?
But before that, we're going to play our final track. And it's a beautiful track. For all you out there, it's called You Are Loved, and it's by Rebecca St. James.
Joy 94.9 is a GLBTIQ community radio station in Melbourne, Australia. Support Joy 94.9 by becoming a member at joy.org.au.
This podcast was produced by Joy Media. You can support Joy's diverse sound and diverse community this June by donating to Joy Radiothon 2024. Go to joy.org.au/radiothon. And remember, we all flourish with joy.